offering our loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari Shankar from the Shri Satyasai Central Trust. We are here to start a new discourse in the series that we've been going through, the 1991 Summer Course series. This series is focused on the Upanishads, and the last discourse that we had, which was the fifth discourse in the series, was on the Keno Upanishad. So this week it's going to be a new Upanishad, and I'm sure it's going to be interesting, and there'll definitely be a lot more new things to learn. So before we start an introduction and introducing the topic of this discourse, I'll invite Hari to join all of us. Saddam Hari. Right, and as I was just saying, that it's a new discourse this time. The discourse which Swami delivered on 26th of May.
Yes.
1991.
During the summer course.
Yeah. Right.
And in this discourse, we are covering the Prashnopanishad, right? Swami, actually, I think Swami addresses the first question of the Prashnopanishad in this particular discourse.
Right. The Prashnopanishad, as the name suggests, it's a Upanishad of questions.
Yes.
And the whole Upanishad is structured on, I think, six questions.
Six,
right?
Questions. There are, as to put it like in a nutshell, essentially there are several students who come to Sage Pippalada, and they all ask, so all of them actually have some background in Vedic studies.
Right.
And they are sort of familiar with the concept of Brahman,
mm-hmm.
but yet they want to learn from a teacher.
Right.
So they come to a guru who they have heard is like enlightened, and he knows subtle secrets about Brahman. So it is with that intent that they have come to this guru, that is Sage Pippalada. And six students, they ask him like questions one by one. And in the replies that he gives to these students, so is contained a lot of, you know, deep secrets from Vedanta.
Right.
So that this Upanishad actually communicates through the medium of these conversations between the sage and his disciples.
Right.
That what is the nature of Brahman. In fact, we'll find some overlap. See, the last Keno Upanishad, we spoke about the senses,
mm-hmm.
and how we come to our senses regarding the senses. Right?
Right.
So here it almost takes off from that same point and goes a little further. So to speak a little bit about the Prashnopanishad, it is from the Atharva Veda.
Right.
And it is considered one of the Mukhya Upanishads. So of all the several Upanishads that there are, we have got 108, right, which are considered as the Mukhya Upanishads.
I think this is the fourth in that.
This is the fourth, yes. This is the fourth in that. It is from the Atharva Veda. In fact, Swami mentions that this is like a commentary on the Mundaka Upanishad.
Right.
Swami says that whatever concepts are spoken about in brief in the Mundaka Upanishad, they are again elaborated in the Prashna Upanishad. So that is in brief. So six questions which are asked. Of that, the fourth question is considered to be the most profound question.
Right.
And the other two are like follow up. After that, two follow up questions. In some places, it is written that actually there are only four questions to begin with.
Okay. Yeah, the two
and
were
the
kind
two
of added.
Have been like over time they have kind of mm-hmm. been added to the Upanishad, but the original text is supposed to have only four questions.
Right. In fact, I was reading somewhere the commentary on Prashnopanishad, especially the Western philosophers looking at it.
Mm.
They were looking at it from the point of view of the education system and in
yes.
those times,
yes,
you know,
yes.
as it comes across. Because as we all know, our typical our Western education or the current day education, because
mm.
it's no more Western, it's as universal as anything which is universal.
Yes.
So, it's not like the teacher comes and presents the topic in the form of a question and answer.
Yeah.
So generally we do, you know, we have even our textbooks these days are like that.
Mm.
There's a question and then the explanation is in the form of the answer is actually the theory of that subject itself.
Mm.
But here he says that, you know, there are these students, as you said, they're already little well-versed in the subject.
Because they have come from such families. They already come with a little bit of background.
Exactly. And so it is like they coming and putting forth their understanding in the form of a question and expressing what they seek to know.
Yeah.
And then the guru kind of fills in what, you know, the missing pieces.
Correct. They're already very deep questions to begin with. You wouldn't expect an average student, so to speak, to even come up with these questions. Right?
Exactly. In fact, you know, that is the beauty. This morning I was just wondering the difference between prashna and, you know, samshaya. Because Swami would say samshayatma vinashyate. Having doubts, you perish. So you're not supposed to have doubts, but you can have questions. Right? So doubts is, it is like you're not sure whether you're going to get the answer or not. I think questions is, you know, the answer is there. But I need to ask the right questions too, so that the, you know, the explanation comes out and it is more palatable.
Yeah, it's like from a sense of wonder or curiosity. Right? Like
genuineness. You know,
genuine inquiry. And in fact, the Swami makes it very clear that these students who came, you know, they first come to the sage and then they directly ask him, like, can you teach us the secrets of the Brahman? And at that time he says that I need you to stay with me for 1 year.
Right.
And he gives them certain conditions, like this is how you must live. And only after that will I start, you know, answering your questions.
Right.
So, like, you know, like, just like for Swami, when you come as a devotee, and all of us would come there with the hopes that Swami would call us for an interview the day we arrived. Right? But, you know, Swami would put us through so many, like so many filters, right? He would take us through joys and disappointments and all that. So there would be a lot of testing that Swami would do before he would, then we could put our questions to him.
Right.
So, even I recall, you know, once in one conversation with Swami, I had this, you know, kind of doubt I had. I wanted to ask Swami something spiritual. The thing was that I wasn't much into inquiry or I didn't have the background for that.
Okay.
And yet, you know, some conversation with Swami, something I thought, you know, I'm talking to Swami, I should ask him something spiritual. Right? And so I decided that I would ask him about Gayatri Mantra. I said, like, Swami, should we do the Gayatri Upasana? And Swami, the look that he gave me, it was very clear he knew that I was asking the question just for the sake of asking. That there was no, you know, inquiry into it. And there was, I had not put any thought into it myself. So it wasn't an earnest question.
Right.
It was trying to make conversation with Swami. And so he said, see, that is not for you right now. You know, so I could sense, you know, I felt a sense of disappointment with myself that I had really not put in that hard work which should have then earned me the right to ask Swami that question.
It just reminds me of a beautiful Zen story I read long back. There is this man who goes to the master and, you know, he's really troubled because of the ways of the world, ups and downs and, you know, pleasure and pain. So he goes to the master and says, Master, tell me now, what is the purpose of life? You know, you go after something, sometimes there is success, sometimes there is failure. You do your best, but nothing happens. Sometimes, you know, just a stroke of luck. So he says, it's all confusing. I really want to know what's the idea behind all of this. So the master says, yeah, this is the idea. Okay. So what do you mean this is the idea? This is the purpose of all that.
Yeah.
So he said, one day you will stop and ask, what is the idea behind all this? And, you know, that genuineness with which you ask, the whole thing is, you know, the spirit of confusion is so that, you know, you literally vomit out that question in frustration and say that I really want to know. And that's what it is, prashna, because even that Swami would quote that incident in Shirdi Avatar, that pariprashna. Shirdi Baba gives the explanation of the word pariprashna. He says it's not just asking a question, but asking out of genuine curiosity and genuine inquiry, as you said, you know, born out of a period of inquiry, that you are really asking to you know, close a gap in your understanding.
Yes.
It is not asking for asking's sake, because we've seen that with Swami, as you're saying, many times Swami would say, ask a question. And one of the questions which will always pop up is, Swami, you know, mind is unstable or something like that. You are not lying, but as we were discussing, it's not a question in that sense. It's not a question that Swami was asking, you know, was urging us to ask.
Yeah.
It was just a question for the sake of asking. And at that time, Swami will get very upset. He'll say, I've explained so many times, you keep asking the same things. And you know, and you could see that that sometimes Swami will respond to the question, you know. We were going through a video where somebody is asking a very, very beautiful question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, philosophically, it's a very beautiful question.
Mm-hmm.
But Swami is dismissing it off.
Mm-hmm.
Swami is saying, just for the sake of asking questions, you ask.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's only that Swami is able to gauge, you know, from where that question is really coming.
Yeah, because, see, sometimes a lot of us, like, I think we like to indulge in some of these questions. Like, for example, karma. Like, people ask, like, so many varied, you know, we create so many situations and we say, like, how does karma, how can you explain? You know, sometimes when we speak to audiences, like, about what Swami's philosophy or our experiences, they come back with some questions like this. And it is, they are very, tough questions to answer, right? They're very involved, intricate.
Right. Right.
And then sometimes I wonder, like, what would Swami have said, you know, like, not talking about the quality of the reply, but very often, like, Swami would actually look if that question was relevant to your life.
Right,
like,
exactly.
Did it come from some life experience, or taking that theory, you got so involved with the concept that now you're trying to analyze it rather than trying to apply it in your life. Because as far as karma is concerned, you could look at it two different ways. One is that, you know, you will face the consequences in the future of what you're doing right now. So, look out.
Right.
Watch out.
Right.
Like, that's all. If you want to apply it, like, that's all there is. Pretty simple. Right. So, that's what. So, I think, like, all these questions, like, whatever we put to ourselves or we put to Swami, it should be very clear that they illumine some area of our life.
Right.
You know? So, it's not to do with some conceptual, you know, discussions.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, in fact, as we go through this discourse, we will come to see the desperation with which the question is asked.
Mm.
And when the clarity doesn't come in the answer, you know, you will find a certain amount of restlessness from the point of the person who is asking the question.
Yeah.
It is not a superficial irritation, but as I was saying that, you know, when you have that real earnestness to have that clarity, if the clarity doesn't is not forthcoming, then you are really disappointed. You know, that's what we would see in this one. And you're saying it's a very beautiful discourse. It's very, very deep, and the other funny thing which I found in this discourse was the way it is starting, just like the previous one, because funny is the wrong word, but a very amusing thing, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
The way Swami starts the discourse, just like the previous discourse, Swami started off by speaking of love.
Mm-hmm.
And how we saw, you know, very, very seamlessly Swami bringing the concept of devotion and love into the thing. So I think even this discourse, Swami starts with an interesting thing like that.
Mm.
So we'll go into the discourse, we'll listen to the first clip, and we will take it on from there.
Paroparaya phalanti vruchah Paropakaraya phalanti vruchha Paropakaraya vahanti nadyaha Paropakaraya duhanti gavaha Paropakarartham idam shariram Paropakarartham idam shariram
Prema Swarupulara Paropakarartha nimittamai
Embodiments of love. It is for the purpose of being of use to others. Trees give fruits to the world. Trees do not eat their own fruits. It is for the sake of others, the trees bear fruits. the trees express such sacred feelings.
పరోపకారార్థమై నదులు ప్రవహించుచున్నవి.
It is for the sake of others, rivers flow.
తమ జలములు తాము గ్రోలవు.
They don't drink their own water.
తమ జలమునంతయి కూడను జగత్తులకు అందించి పరోపకారార్థమై ప్రవహించుచున్నది.
They give away all their water to the world and flow for others' welfare.
పరోపకారార్థ నిమిత్తమై పశువులు క్షీరమును మానవులకు అందించుచున్నది.
Cows, to be of use to others, give milk to humanity.
తమ పాలను త్రాగవు.
They don't drink their own milk.
కాని మానవుడు పరోపకారార్థం ఇదం శరీరం. ఈ శరీరము ధరించినది పరోపకార నిమిత్తమయ్యని సత్యాన్ని విస్మరించి స్వార్థము స్వప్రయోజనము అనేటువంటి యొక్క సంకుచితమైనటువంటి మార్గమును అవలంబిస్తున్నాడు.
However, man having forgotten this truth, that this body has been given for the purpose of being useful to others, takes to the narrow-minded path of self-interest and selfishness.
ఈనాటి మానవునకు వృక్షములకున్న త్యాగము కాని పశువులకున్న త్యాగము కాని నదులకున్నటువంటి త్యాగము కాని ఈ త్యాగములలో వెయ్యింట ఒక భాగమైన కూడాను మానవుడి యందు లేకుండా పోచున్నది.
Man of today does not even have 1,000th of the sacrifice that the trees, rivers and cows possess.
తెల్లవారి లేచినది మొదలు రాత్రి పరుండునంత వరకు స్వార్థము స్వార్థము స్వార్థము.
From the moment one wakes up at dawn to the time one falls asleep at night, it is all selfishness, selfishness and selfishness.
ఈనాటి దేశము ఇన్ని విధములైనటువంటి యొక్క అవస్థలకు గురి కావడానికి కారణమేమిటి? స్వార్థము స్వప్రయోజనమే.
What is the reason behind the turmoil the country is undergoing today? It is the selfishness and self-interest.
స్వార్థము అవసరమే.
Selfishness is essential.
స్వప్రయోజనము కూడాను అవసరమే.
Self-interest is also necessary.
కాని నశ్రేయో నియమం వినా కొంత హద్దులో ఉంటుండాలి ఈ స్వార్థమును కూడా.
But there can be no welfare without limits. Even selfishness must be within certain limits.
కనుకనే దివ్యత్వమైనటువంటిది మానవుని యందు ఏమాత్రము కూడాను గోచరించటం లేదు.
That's why divinity is not to be seen in a human being.
మానవుడు మానవుడిగా కూడాను జీవించడానికి ప్రయత్నించటం లేదు.
Man is not even making an effort to live as a man.
మానవుడు మానవుడిగా జీవించితే ఇదే నిజమైన మానవత్వము మాధవత్వము.
If man were to live like a man, that in itself is humanness, divinity.
Yeti kaladanu chuntiro, yeti kaladanu chuntiro, adi ledu. Yeti ledanu chuntiro, adi kaladu. Unnadokkate daivambu ennatikini. Leni daiyanu జగతును కానరయ్యా. లేని దయ్యను ఈ జగత్తు కానరయ్యా. లేని దయ్యను లేని దయ్యను ఈ జగత్తు కానరయ్యా.
What you say exists does not exist. What you say doesn't exist exists. Only God exists at all times. Behold the world that was always non-existent. The whole world is permeated by divinity. World doesn't exist separately. The whole world is permeated by Lord Vishnu.
సర్వం కలివిదం బ్రహ్మ.
All of this is Brahma.
ఈశావాస్యం ఇదం సర్వం.
The entire universe is permeated by God.
జగత్తు వేరు దైవత్వం వేరు కాదు.
world and divinity are not distinct.
ఇది ఏకత్వమును గురించి ప్రశ్నోపనిషత్తు చక్కగా ప్రబోధం జరుపుతూ వచ్చింది.
It is about this oneness the Prashnopanishad began imparting lessons.
ప్రతి పదార్థమునకు ఒకటి పరార్థము అనేటువంటిది ఉంటున్నది.
Every object or padartha has a higher basis or parartha.
పరార్థము ఆధారము లేక పదార్థము గోచరము కాదు.
Without the basis, the object cannot be understood.
ప్రాణము లేని ప్రాణి ప్రాణికి అస్తిత్వము శూన్యము.
A living being without the life force or prana ceases to exist.
అదే విధముగానే
in the same way
పరార్థము లేనిటువంటి యొక్క పదార్థము నిరుపయోగము.
Objects without their basis are useless.
పదార్థము మూలము పరార్థము మూలము పదార్థము స్థూలము.
Pararartha is the source, padartha is the gross.
Parartham aadharamu, padartham aadeyamu.
While parartha is the basis, padartha is the effect.
Bhautika drishtito priyini parikinchinappudu ivi rendu kudanu paraspara viruddhamuga gocharistuntayi.
When viewed from the worldly perspective, these two appear contrary to each other.
Kani tatva drishtito chuchinappudu ఈ ప్రాణము లేని ప్రాణి కాని ఆధారము లేని ఆధేయము కాని జడము కానటువంటి చైతన్యము కాని చైతన్యము లేని జడము కాని జగత్తులో కానరాదు.
హౌఎవర్ వెన్ వీ సీ త్రూ అ స్పిరిచువల్ ఐ ఇట్ ఇస్ ఇంపాసిబుల్ టు పర్సీవ్ ఇన్ ద వరల్డ్ అ లివింగ్ ఫార్మ్ వితౌట్ లైఫ్ ద బేస్డ్ వితౌట్ ద బేసిస్ ద ఇనర్ట్ వితౌట్ కాన్షియస్నెస్ or a consciousness without the inert.
So that was the first clip of the discourse, and the reason why I said I found that beginning of that discourse very, very interesting is how Swami starts with the seva, or you know, living for others, as Swami would put it, paropakaram, as the basis of human life. You know, because when you talk of higher concepts, when you're especially talking about very, very philosophical concepts, you're looking at, you know, like what came in the later part of that clip. You know, padartha or parartha or adhiyam, and you know, some kind of words like that. But Swami starts with a concept which is so close home, you know, you don't have to think too hard to understand that. Swami starts with examples of trees and rivers and all that. And I'm sure it's going to be very, very fascinating to see how in the later part of the discourse Swami comes back to this concept, and he says that, you know, when you really live these Upanishadic values and lessons, this is how it will express itself in your daily life.
Very natural manifestation. Because in, I think it's also some of us may be addicted to the concept of service.
Right.
And, you know, we... like we don't know what is the joy that we are deriving from it, but there is something unexamined perhaps for some of us, because we keep serving others and then we don't feel nourished, or you know, we don't learn something from that. It just becomes an automatic thing, maybe to look good in front of others or something that we undertake, right? So we could be, you know, as far as people are concerned, we are out there serving society, right? But what is that inner motivation for that? What intention is getting served by you serving out there? That is not, you know, examined by us.
Right. And
so Swami is making it very clear that these are some of the preparatory, you know, rites that you have to undertake before you actually become somebody who is a person of service to society.
Right. And you know, whenever Swami speaks of this concept of paropakaram, to look at it as only a service, it's a very, very narrow-minded approach. Because when Swami says paropakaram, you give up selfishness, you know, and self-interest. A lot of other concepts come in, because when Swami speaks about Sanskriti or culture, Swami would say culture is concern for others. So when you say concern for others, I mean, you might be traveling in a business class flight, But you thinking of, you know, am I disturbing the person next to me? Am I in any way causing discomfort to the person next to me? Even that becomes paropakaram, actually.
Yes.
That you are, you know, factoring the other person's wellness in your thinking, in your actions. That becomes paropakaram. So culture is actually an expression of what Swami says is paropakaram.
Yes.
Or if you say that, you know, as a person in the family, you think more of your responsibilities than your rights.
Right.
You know, as a father, you're thinking that, no, this is my responsibility. I can cut down on my what is my comfort and what is my leisure. This is my duty. I have to do this. That is also an expression of paropakaram.
Yes.
And going out in the society, if you talk about civic sense, like, you know, Swami would say that you're going through a road. You might not come back through the road again, but you find a stone on the way, you pick it up and throw it away.
Exactly.
You are not going to come back to, you know, benefit from that act of yours, but you're doing it because that's your nature. You know, somebody will be affected, so let me do that.
Yeah. See, like what we commonly understand, like when we look at a person and we say that he's a man of refinement,
right,
a person of refinement. What we generally mean to say that is that he or she has a sophisticated way of speaking,
right,
polite. They're polite or gracious in their mannerisms, etc.
Right.
But, you know, that is nothing to say of what the person actually is inside, right? And it's true of almost each one of us. We are essentially humans, right? Like, and we have an animal nature within each one of us. So, when we speak of this refinement, we're actually, we are the ability, the extent to which we can separate ourselves from such animal urges, right? Or the, what we call as, you know, the lizard brain, the first impulses, like as the extent to which we can separate ourselves from that, to that extent, we are recognized as, you know, people of...
cultured, right.
Yeah, cultured refinement. But that also means that you're, you know, you're, you naturally then start behaving in a way that you become sensitive to people around you.
Right.
It's like, so that, so the entire yoga, all of the sadhana that we do is essentially to separate ourselves or from acting on those first impulses.
Right. So exactly. If you look at it in the Gita, Krishna says, there are four types of devotees, artha, artasi, artarthi, and jignasu and jnani. It's surprising that even a jignasu is actually not the best. Because even a jignasu is looking for something that he can take for himself.
Yes.
You know, there is a certain amount of selfishness. But when you talk of a devotee who has completely surrendered, I mean, there is zero self-interest there. When you talk about complete surrender, not the surrender which you and I can claim to have, but the level of surrender which Swami expects from a devotee, you are not even looking at a state of, you know, elevated heaven or anything like that.
Yeah.
You're only saying that, you know, whatever pleases you, I'll do that. Whatever you're happy with, you do that. This life is mine, whatever happens, I mean, it's your, this one. I mean, that selflessness that Swami is talking about here becomes so natural. And, you know, that is why even in the previous discourse that Swami gave that so much importance to devotion in that middle of that discourse when he was explaining that concept of going beyond the senses, going beyond the mind. And, of course, interestingly, Swami says that, you know, selfishness and self-interest is necessary to an extent.
Yeah.
But there should be limits even to that.
Yes. You cannot, you know, abandoning self-interest altogether. Actually, you know, this Dr. Samuel Sandweiss, he's written this book, Spirit and the Mind. And actually there he distinguishes how the ego, in even in psychology it is understood that the ego is necessary to exist up to a certain extent, right? Otherwise, we, like, imagine that if a baby were there, completely selfless, it wouldn't cry when it felt the pangs of hunger, wouldn't be able to communicate to anybody outside, right? And likewise, if you look at children, right, if they do not have a certain amount of ego, you know, it doesn't, what do you say, make them, you know, compete with each other. They don't learn. It actually is necessary up to a certain extent.
Right? Right.
And he mentions that Swami mentioned to him exactly the same thing. You know, he says that Swami says that the ego is required up to a certain extent, but then after beyond a certain point of time, you got to now start examining like how much it is ruling your life, and then slowly, you know, diminishing the effects of that ego.
In fact, you know, this morning we were playing a discourse and Swami says, Swami is talking about patriotism, patriotism.
Okay.
So Swami makes a very interesting point there. He says, as long as Dehabhimanam is there, Deshabhimanam is good. Right?
Very good.
That's what you were saying, that you know, we get our concepts all, you know, the order of the concepts wrong.
Yeah.
Today we are talking of being global citizens.
Yeah.
But Swami says you can't, you know, give up that idea of my country and love for my country as long as you have the Dehabhimanam. And just like, as you're saying, the Dehabhimanam is good to a certain extent because, you know, that gives you that responsibility towards yourself and the people around you. That comes from a little bit of Dehabhimanam. So as long as that is there, this love for your society, this love for your, you know, the bigger society in the form of the nation is so very important.
Yeah.
So when Swami says that self-interest has to have its limits, and I think it's that balance which comes with wisdom.
Yeah, it's like at some point of time you should take responsibility for that existing and maybe start using the ego when it is required. like if you see so many times, like if you look at Bhagwan's life also, there are many times where he would assert himself, right? Like saying that, look, I am the teacher here, and you have, no, we have to maintain our roles and responsibilities, right? So wherever it is appropriate, like it's not like that Swami, like we have an idealized thing called egolessness, but Swami wasn't that way. Like, where needed, where it is appropriate, he would demonstrate the ego. But that didn't mean that he was under the influence of ego. But if necessary, he would assert himself to be the individual.
Right.
And where it was not required, he would abandon that and then be, you know, completely at the service of society. Right. Like, that is a very important thing that Swami is conveying.
So I think that is that's the greatest thing to achieve in a sense. That, you know, that ability to know that when you're supposed to assert yourself, when you're supposed to hold yourself back, when a little bit of self-interest is good, when, you know, when is it selfishness and when is it, you know, rightful self-interest.
Yeah.
I mean, every dilemma is like that. The dilemma which Arjuna has also is that only, you know.
It's completely tied up with the concept of dharma. It is
right,
like,
exactly.
This whole thing is so intricate.
Right. And, you know, that's the thing which came to my mind when you're talking about we conjuring some situations and asking what is the right thing to do that or how karma will play out like that. From Swami's point of view, Swami would, I mean, there would be a simplistic approach from Swami's point of view. You know, we are thinking about the factors and how many what percentage of this factor will have to influence your decision. But from Swami's point of view, look, if you've led a life which is dharmic till that point in time, the decision will be so spontaneous, you'll not be wandering like this. You know, from Swami's point, it was so clear. I think that is what it is, that, you know, when you're talking about that balance, knowing what is right, what is wrong, it is. And in fact, we'll come to that part where these disciples, when they come and ask the Guru, that's what he says. That can you lead a life of, you know, certain amount of morality, a certain amount of humility, and then come and ask me this question. And very interestingly, he says the actual verse, the first verse of the Prashnopanishad, I think, the reply of the Guru, the first reply which he gives, he says, if we have the answer, we'll share it with you. You know, very beautifully. And that's why the Western philosophers actually look at it, and he says that, you know, here is this Guru. One of the primary qualities that he expects from his students is humility. And he is himself expressing
demonstrating
it. He's saying that if I have the answer, I'll share it with you. Then suddenly there's a gear shift where, you know, till this point Swami speaks about the selflessness and how paropkaram is so important, living for the others is the essence of life. Then suddenly Swami starts saying that what you think exists does not exist. What you see is not what really is. There is a hidden basis, and that is the importance to that. And I think the later part Swami will connect the two and how it comes. But I mean, as you're saying, that when we go through this process and imbibe these principles of the Upanishads, it will automatically express itself as what Swami calls as, you know, living for the others and selflessness. And maybe it is even interchangeable, as Swami would say. You start by practicing these values,
right,
and then you're prepared to receive that, the wisdom too.
Yeah, and the verse that Swami speaks about, what you think you see does not exist, right? And what you cannot see alone exists. This is an echo from like what we heard in the last discourse,
right.
Keno Upanishad. And because what we take for real is what we perceive outside. And Swami says that the reality is not found. You're looking in the wrong direction for the reality. And you have to look inwards. And I think yet again, this the Upanishad as well as this discourse again stresses on similar points. Right?
Right.
The senses are essentially taking us for a ride. And getting lost in that ride, getting immersed in that ride is what is, you know, preventing us from getting aware of our own reality.
Right.
Which, as Swami says, that always exists. Like, for all time, there is only one God. And only God exists and not the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like Swami says, that is always permanent. That's what exists all the time. And you getting immersed in what you see and taking that for real is preventing you from becoming aware of what is always there, the substratum, what is permanent.
Right. And before this point, Swami actually makes a very, very beautiful statement about human nature.
Mm.
And he says that, you know, if you can live like a human, it's equal to attaining divinity.
Yeah, yes.
So it's almost like a state of equilibrium where, you know, you're able to live that human life to perfection.
Yeah.
After that, there's nothing to do, nothing to achieve.
Precisely.
That it almost like puts you in a cruise mode and you're heading there. I mean, if you don't do anything wrong, you're getting there anyway. But, you know, that shows how difficult it is to maintain that state of humanness.
Mm.
Because, you know, and immediately after that, Swami is talking about, you know, what you see is not really what is. That means that the importance which you give to that processing that happens behind the senses.
Yes.
You were speaking about it even in the last discourse.
Mm.
You know, your eyes are perceiving some things.
Mm.
Your ears are bringing in some information.
Mm.
But the ability of that mind to process all of this and process a bit of what memory you have and your projection of from the memory. So this situation could be like this. And then the constant thing of putting all these things together and that mosaicing, and then you say that, okay, this is what is exactly the hidden agenda behind it, or the hidden idea.
Yeah.
I think that is the idea of humanness.
Yes, right? And just one layer behind that is the idea of discrimination.
Right,
because
exactly.
Simply put, that's what separates the rest of creation
exactly
from the human beings.
Like, you know, the other day I was seeing a picture, National Geographic had released a picture.
Mm.
There's this huge 5-star hotel in Africa, and they have a massive lobby. You know, like all these 5-star hotels have. And there's a family of elephants which is going through that lobby.
Oh.
Okay. And the description is very, very interesting. They were saying that, you know, this is a problem which they're facing in Africa.
Right.
Because we know that wildlife is so extensively present in Africa.
Yeah.
And you have this development which is happening.
Yeah.
And many of these animals, they are like so programmed to migrate from one point to the other.
Right.
And for generations, they've been taking a straight route.
Yeah.
So if you build anything there, many places, they have elephants walking through the center of the city.
So,
so they make the lobby so big so that these elephants can walk through.
Very sweet.
No, I mean, that's how much programmed an animal life is.
Yeah.
That's what we see that. But that is where the difference between an animal life and human life comes,
yeah,
where you're constantly taking in inputs. And there is one part of you which is actually staying away from all of this,
yes,
and trying to put everything together.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where you need detachment, because if you're going to be pulled by happiness and sorrow, you can't do that analysis in that level of peace.
Yeah. So somebody is actually describing this. You know, how if you look at how evolution happens, you look at all you know, the for a very long time the only living beings are that which could live in the sea.
Right. Right. Right.
And so there were a certain set of possibilities of how you could live, right? So you swim in the water, you breathe. And then, like, one fine day, we don't know how, but there's this one fish probably
jumped
right,
out.
Which jumped out and decided it could survive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it liked what it saw in the land.
Mm-hmm.
And then the, you know, whole thing starts from there, right? The
mm-hmm.
the possibility of actually climbing trees.
Right. Flying.
And then, or flight.
Right?
And then
right.
you have, then you have, It all leads to people who can then sit and wonder about, you know, this whole of existence. Right? It sometimes, I mean, truly speaking, man himself is a wonder. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about it. That if we can understand that, you know, a person sitting here can compute how old this universe is.
Right.
If they can pin it down to a number like 13.7 billion years, it's an unbelievable achievement. I don't know if you can really appreciate what that means.
Now, talking about what they talk now, I think gravitational wave.
Yes,
it is like the very, very minute,
that
blip itself is almost like a blip in gravitation.
I'm like trained as a naval architect, and I remember the first time that I'm at Cochin Shipyard, the dry dock, and an oil tanker was being repaired. I remember standing near the rudder, just looking at that huge contraption of iron, steel, with such structures on top of that. And I wondered at that person who thought that this thing can float on water.
Right, exactly.
The enormous confidence, right? I mean, I think the same awe one feels when you, stand in front of a Boeing or an Airbus, and you wonder, you know, this, that such a, there must be such intricate, you know, fail-safe things, structures built that people feel confident to get into that thing and sail through the air. It's I mean, incredible, actually. We don't give ourselves enough credit when we get into these discussions, but it really is true. And that becomes a responsibility, right? And Swami says, okay, good, I'm happy you've come so far, but there's like lot more you can do.
I mean, that's the beauty, you know, when, as you're saying, that just sitting and reminiscing about the progress mankind has made, or looking at the achievements which have been done, I mean, in a very short time, actually, if you look at it, it's just about 300 years. You know, it's very, very short time. But then Swami, from his level, he looks at it and says, is that all you've got?
Yeah.
You know, you're capable of much more than that. Then you know, it really hits you what is the capacity of this human intellect in that sense.
And it wasn't just saying, Prem. The thing was that Swami could embody that, and we could see it for us.
Exactly.
You know?
And every time Swami said that, you can do this.
Yeah.
You know, that
like, had Swami been like, you know, a disembodied voice, right, that was communicating things to us, maybe through somebody, or we just hear, you know, in our heads, like, would that have the same effect as looking at a person, like, with a physical frame like yours? And if you look at his life, the trials and tribulations and all that, and then saying that, look, like, it is possible to live like God while in a human body. That's an extraordinary, fortune.
Exactly. I mean, it really fills you with so much awe, because one thing is, as you're saying, the achievements that man has made, and then Swami saying that that's nothing compared to what you can.
Yeah.
And then you look at the creation itself. I mean, you look at the creation as God's achievement, in a sense.
Yeah.
And God has created it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have this Purusha Suktam which says that one quarter of my glory has become the creation. Three quarters is not manifest at all. And that's God. And then Swami saying that you and I are one.
Right.
I mean, it really blows yourself out of proportion. It's like, once I was reading about, if you were to draw the solar system to scale, you know, what it would be.
Yeah.
It's like, because we've been seeing the wrong reference all the time.
Yeah.
It's unimaginable to see that what it is, what is the size exactly.
Yeah.
It's almost like that, you know, living in our day-to-day things, like, okay, lunch is over, what's about dinner? I mean, we're living in that sense. It doesn't fill us with that enough awe to think, what is it that we really are, you know, containing in this body?
Yeah.
As Swami would say that, you know, this is only the container. Look at the container. Adharam and Adheyam, which Swami says, that's what it is. Well, I think the starting point is that awe.
The entire wonder.
That wonder, right, exactly.
And that Swami says, like, don't stop here. Yeah, you've got a lot, but...
Yeah. Right. So I think we'll... we'll conclude with that today. Dear listeners, we're going to finish on time for Bishu's new segment. We're starting a new show today, and Bishu is going to be hosting that. So, on behalf of Hari, I thank you all for joining, and we offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Do join us again next week at 7:30. We'll continue this discourse on the Prashnopanishad. And as you heard, it is again one of the discourses which we've done retranslation. The translation was in Brother Sunil's voice. So again, thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for joining all of us. In a short while, Bishu will be here for his new program, Utsaha. So till we meet you next week, Sai Ram.